I was extremely pleased when Bob asked me to chair tonight's lecture because I find privacy, which is the subject of tonight's lecture, a very interesting, though also a difficult and demanding subject. It stands, in my view, at the juncture of two very important human rights, individual liberty and freedom of speech and opinion. And on the one hand, it seems to bring two aspects of human personality into paradoxical conflict, and on the other, it seems to represent a paradigm clash between the individual and civil and political rights, which are essential in democratic societies. I feel that no one is better qualified to discuss these issues and share his experience than tonight's lecturer, whom we know well as the Professor of Social Work Studies in the school since 1978, Professor Robert Pinker. Professor Pinker's interest in this demanding area of social policy is a very long-standing one. He's been interested in self-regulation for many years, and in 1981 he became involved with the Advertising Standards Authority. He was also a founder member of the Press Complaints Commission in 1991 and subsequently became its privacy commissioner, which a post which he still holds. So we are very fortunate tonight that he is going to share his experiences with us. Professor Pinker.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to be speaking to you tonight in this famous old theatre, where I have appeared and spoken before on other more workaday occasions. The surroundings are certainly familiar, although this evening my status is less clear-cut than usual, since I am both playing away on behalf of the Press Complaints Commission and playing at home on behalf of the school. In my approach this evening, I will try to cover three aspects of my chosen subject. I will say something about the origins, the constitution, and the remit of the commission. Then I will present and discuss some examples of the kinds of complaint we receive about press intrusions into people's privacy. And I will conclude with a defense of self-regulation with reference to some recent criticisms of the work of the Commission and some recent proposals that might affect its future development. The Commission was established in 1991 as a successor to the old Press Council, which was widely considered to have become inefficient and painstakingly slow in responding to complaints. The industry responded swiftly to Sir David Calcutt's critical report of 1990 in setting up a Press Standards Board of Finance to raise an annual levy, to establish the new commission, a code committee of industry members to draft a code of practice, and a committee to appoint the chairman and the members of the new commission. The early days of the PCC were often fraught and often difficult. The future of self-regulation was very much in the balance. And when the full story comes to be told, the vitally important contribution of the Commission's first chairman, Lord MacGregor of Durris, will, I am sure, be generously acknowledged. The Commission currently consists of 16 members, the majority of them laymen, working under its independent chairman, now Lord Wakeham. The Commission is a self-regulatory body, entirely independent of both industry and government. It receives and deals with complaints falling within the remit of the industry's own code of practice. And the code is kept under continuous review by a committee made up of working editors. This code of practice is the bedrock of the Commission's work, but its provisions are not set in stone. They are responsive to changing practices and technology in the industry, to the concerns of readers, and to changes in public attitudes and values. New modifications, new additions have been made concerning such issues as the use of listening devices and long lens cameras, the definition of private property, of public interest, the prevention of jigsaw identification, particularly in child sex cases, and the procedures to be followed in dealing with hospital authorities. And the process of reviewing this code will soon restart under new procedures to be announced shortly by the Code Committee of the Commission. And these new arrangements will, we hope, ensure a louder voice for the public in monitoring the difficult balance we have to hold between rights and freedoms. When a complaint is upheld, the offending newspaper or periodical must and does publish the Commission's critical adjudication with full prominence. The Commission also publishes all its own adjudications, both the upheld and the rejected complaints, and also a note of every complaint received. In 1993, the industry agreed that the Commission should have the facility to ask a proprietor publisher to consider disciplinary action in appropriate circumstances where a breach was considered to be gross or flagrant. And to underpin the progress we have made in recent years, more and more publishers are writing a requirement to abide by the code into contracts and conditions of employment. The newspaper industry has given 100% support to the Commission in the administration of the code. No newspaper, no periodical has refused to publish an adverse adjudication. More importantly, over 70% of all the complaints investigated have been resolved informally to the satisfaction of the parties involved through the intervention, through the mediation of the Commission. Complaints about inaccuracy are actually by far the most numerous of all the complaints received. They account for over 70% of the total resolved since 1991. Privacy currently accounts for just over 12% of all the complaints investigated. But privacy has a significance in the mind of the public that goes beyond numbers and percentages. That is why the Commission appointed one of its members, currently myself, to have special responsibility for considering investigations into complaints about intrusions into people's privacy, and to prepare and to submit draft adjudications to the full Commission under its chairman. In quantitative terms, therefore, the cases of unjustified intrusion brought before the Commission are only a very small part of its work, and most of these complaints are resolved informally without recourse to final adjudication. Yet, the importance of an issue is not necessarily related to questions of numbers. Invasions of privacy can be deeply hurtful to the individuals affected. Their effects can extend to relatives, to friends, and they are just as hurtful and embarrassing to ordinary citizens as to public figures. You will search the code of practice in vain for a definition of privacy which either describes it as an unqualified right or breaks it down into specific subcategories concerning the public disclosure of embarrassing private facts or intrusions into a person's physical seclusion or the unauthorized use of someone's image or likeness. There is, in fact, a long record of failure on the part of many legal authorities and distinguished committees of inquiry in their search for a definition of privacy that might command general agreement and consent. The reason for this lack of agreement is that although privacy is a fundamental human right, it is seldom an absolute right. Our claims to privacy must always be set against other rights, such as those to freedom of expression and the claims of public interest, which, though equally important, often conflict with each other. And the task of trying to reconcile these competing claims is central to all the adjudications which the Commission makes in dealing with complaints about intrusions into people's privacy. As the Commission said recently, the notion of privacy contains a paradox. People can only appreciate the nature of privacy by growing up in a society. In order to be sociable, citizens have to accept limits on their privacy. Privacy is not an absolute, and the right to invade it is not an absolute. And this is a dilemma that all Democrats have to live with. Consequently, any new law of privacy would have to be subject to innumerable qualifications involving the exercise of legal discretion and all the costs and delays that that implies. In a recent article, Sir Louis Blom Cooper and Lisa Pruitt argued that the work of the Commission has been deficient in two respects. Two respects, at least. Its adjudications have lacked a step-by-step analytical quality and any sense of juridical purpose, and that it has consequently failed to provide the industry with a consistent set of guidelines or to subcategorize the various meanings of privacy in the search for an all-embracing and multifaceted dimension. In responding to these comments, it may be helpful if I illustrate how the Commission works with reference to some specific privacy complaints that have gone the full course to an adjudication. Some of these cases involve private figures, and I've intentionally used them in order to highlight the importance of the public interest dimension. I should also add that my references to particular newspapers are fortuitous, in the sense that my intention is to focus on particular cases and not to draw attention to particular publications. Since the Commission was established in 1991, no particular title or category of publication has emerged as a persistent offender. But with that said, I will move on to a few prefatory remarks about public figures and why they seem to have such a high profile in the debate about privacy. Public figures, including members of the royal family, stand at greater risk of press intrusion into their private lives than do ordinary citizens, simply by virtue of being public figures. It can, however, be argued that the potential penalties for being a public figure ought not to be so great or so arbitrary that they deter decent people from entering public vocations. And members of the royal family are, by virtue of birth or marriage, public figures for the rest of their lives. The young Prince William, for example, has no choice in the matter, which is why our chairman, Lord Wakeham, used the occasion of his starting school at Eton to remind the media that he has the same rights to consideration as that of any other child in the kingdom. And public figures are most at risk of press inquiries into the circumstances of their private lives, when what they say and do in public seems to be inconsistent with what they do in their private lives. Now, this issue is covered under Section 18 of our Code of Practice, which states that the other code requirements prohibiting intrusions into privacy, the use of listening devices, the use of subterfuge to obtain information, the resort to photographing people on private property, and other investigations involving telephoning, questioning, may be waived, if it can be shown that they are in the public interest. The exposure of crime and serious misdemeanor and the protection of public health and safety cover two aspects of the public interest. It is, however, that clause, that subsection of Clause 18, that is most frequently invoked by the press as a prima facie public interest justification, if it can be shown that they have prevented the public from being misled by some statement or action of an individual or an organization. Well, as we all know, there are times when public figures see fit to make pronouncements on moral issues affecting the way in which ordinary citizens live their private lives and order their personal relationships. Members of Parliament, of course, have as much right as anyone else to comment on such matters. But when they do, their statements carry a special significance because they are in a position to recommend and introduce changes in the boundaries between those aspects of moral behavior which are subject to legal sanctions and those which are not. Now, the extent to which the law has duties to perform in the enforcement of private morality is itself a highly contentious issue. At one extreme in this debate, authorities like James Fitzjames Stephen and more recently the Lord Devlin have argued that the law has indeed substantial duties to perform in this respect, and that conformity with the tenets of public morality is a precondition for the survival of society itself. And from this perspective, the continuities of social life are thought of as a seamless moral fabric in which the threads of public and private morality are closely interwoven. Unravel one part, the argument goes, and the rest will fall asunder. At the other extreme, libertarians like John Stuart Mill will have maintained that it is possible to draw distinctions between the domains of a public and the domains of a private morality, and between our self-regarding and our other-regarding acts. In any event, it is argued, the law has no right to interfere with private activities that cause no harm to others, and much of what passes for public morality is nothing more than convention anyway. But such clear-cut distinctions are not so easy to draw in practice. Members of Parliament and their constituents, as voters and taxpayers, can be said to have legitimate interests in, for example, the changing mores of private sexual behaviour, if some of these changes result in more single parents and their children becoming dependent on public funds. Whether or not such adverse consequences follow, it can be argued that the public has a right to know when the public statements of politicians are in some way seriously inconsistent with aspects of their own private behavior. And the same holds true when the public image they wish to project of their personal lives is simply misleading. Some politicians use their wives and families, husbands and families, to advance their public careers. And it helps in electioneering to cultivate an impression of marital harmony. If newspapers can show that this impression is a false one, then Clause 18 of the Code allows them to invoke the public interest. It might also be in the public interest to show that the manner in which a public figure conducts his or her private life adversely affects the performance of their public duties. But in practice, it can be extremely difficult to show clear-cut distinctions between public figures and their close relatives when adjudicating on privacy complaints. The funeral of a wife of a well-known politician who has committed suicide is a legitimate matter of public interest. It is, however, difficult, though not impossible, to take photographs of such a tragic occasion without causing distress to those family members present, including young children. Such distinctions are easier to draw in cases where the privacy of a private citizen is invaded, largely or solely because the individual in question is related to a public figure. Two examples serve here, I think, to illustrate the way in which the Commission has drawn or tried to draw such distinctions. In one such case, the family of a young man complained about a front page article in the Daily Mirror that read, "Lily's nephew dying of AIDS." The family complained that the article intruded into the nephew's privacy in a way that could not be justified as being in the public interest. This complaint was also made with reference to Clause 8 of the Code that deals with harassment and the clause that deals with intrusion into grief and shock. The complainant said that although the young man in question was not named, the report taken as a whole made his identification possible. Furthermore, the relations had specifically asked the newspaper not to publish this material. The newspaper, for its part, reiterated that they had not named either the young man or the hospital, and that the public was entitled to know that a relative of a senior cabinet minister who was dying of AIDS, insofar as such a tragedy, brought the impact of this tragic illness to the very center of government. And the editor apologized personally to the family for any distress that had been caused. Now, in its adjudication, the Commission drew a distinction between the way in which the information had been gathered and the nature of its content. It did not find any evidence of harassment or intrusion into grief and shock, and it therefore rejected those parts of the complaint. It did not, however, accept that there was any justifiable basis for publishing a story that constituted in itself a serious intrusion into the confidential medical affairs of a private citizen. And the Commission also rejected the newspaper's claims that the patient's family connection with Mr. Lilly in this case supported the publication of this story in terms of the public interest criteria set out in the Code. And on this ground, the complaint was upheld with Clause 4 of the Code, which deals with privacy. Some complaints raise questions about the use of long-lens cameras and the definition of private property itself. In a case concerning the Prince Edward, we received a complaint on his behalf from the Queen's press secretary that five newspapers had published a photograph showing Prince Edward kissing his friend, Miss Sophie Rees-Jones. The photograph, it was claimed, was taken without consent in breach of the code. There's a section under Clause 4 which says, the use of long lens photography to take pictures of people on private property without their consent is not generally acceptable. And Clause 8 states that unless their inquiries are in the public interest, they shouldn't photograph people on private property without their consent. Now, the code also defines private property as any private residence, together with its garden and outbuildings, but excluding any adjacent fields or parkland. Now, this definition, you will quickly understand, while perfectly adequate with regard to ordinary private houses, is not so easily applied to some of the larger residences and properties in the land. And in this particular case, the photograph was taken by a long lens camera at a time when the couple were standing approximately 10 feet from the front door of a private house on the Queen's estate at Balmoral. Now, the five editors involved separately defended their decision to publish on the grounds that the photograph showed for the first time the serious nature of the relationship between the Prince and Miss Rees-Jones. This, they claimed, was a matter of public interest. The editor of Today thought that the photograph was a charming picture of a happy occasion. The editors of The Mirror, The Express, The Star apologized in the course of the correspondence. The editor of The Sun saw no reason to apologize for informing its readers and defended its decision to publish. The commission upheld the complaint against all five newspapers. It did not accept that the public interest had been served by the publication of the photograph. It was pleased to receive the apologies, but it didn't think that they excused the newspapers. All the editors were asked to remind their staff of the code's provisions regarding long-lens photography, and all the newspapers published the commission's adjudication as they are required to do under the code. And on reflection, I think that one further point of substance was established in this adjudication. Namely, that the code's privacy requirements apply as much to our private joys as to our private sorrows. As it happens, a complaint received earlier this year from the Earl Spencer on behalf of his wife, the Countess Spencer, argued that her privacy had been invaded at a time of acute personal distress. The substance of Earl Spencer's complaint was that the News of the World, in this case, had unjustifiably intruded into the privacy of his wife in breach of Clause 4 and in breach of the clause dealing with hospitals and also harassment. Complaints were also made against The People and the Daily Mirror, and a further complaint against the Mail on Sunday under a clause which deals with, in addition, which deals with misrepresentation. Now, Countess Spencer had been admitted to an addiction clinic, suffering apparently from bulimia and a drinking problem. The News of the World and the Daily Mirror published a story on her condition, including a photograph of her walking in the private grounds of the clinic, which was taken without her permission. The People had published a story, but not a photograph. And in the case of the Mail on Sunday, which had published neither a story nor a photograph, Earl Spencer complained about the intrusive manner in which the investigation had been conducted. The News of the World defended its action on the grounds that Earl Spencer and Countess Spencer were both public figures. They pointed out that in the past, Earl Spencer had encouraged media interest in their home and families in return for fees and publicity. Countess Spencer had given interviews to the press, and by her own actions, had placed the facts of her illness in the public domain. The people made a similar defence and reminded the commission that it hadn't published a photograph because it knew that it would have breached, or thought it would have breached the code had it done so. The editor of the Mirror, Daily Mirror, told the commission that the photograph had been obtained from a usually reliable agency and used on the assurance that it was available for general use. And on receipt of the complaint, the Daily Mirror immediately published a prominent and unreserved apology. The Mail on Sunday maintained that it had acted in strict accordance with the code and had ceased its investigation when asked to do so and had not published anything. In its adjudications, the Commission upheld the complaint against the News of the World. It took such a serious view of what it deemed to be a flagrant breach of the code that it formally drew the matter to the attention of the publisher, Mr. Rupert Murdoch, who publicly reprimanded the editor. The Commission also upheld the complaint against the people. And in the case of the Daily Mirror, the newspaper's explanation was accepted and noted, and also the speed with which it was offered. The complaints against the Daily Mirror were rejected on the grounds that the staff had acted professionally and in accordance with the code throughout their inquiries. I think I mean the Mail on Sunday, I'm sorry. In reaching its decisions with regard to the News of the World and the people, the Commission took the view that people who have previously accepted or even sought publicity through the press should not henceforward be treated as if they had forfeited all their future rights to privacy. In this particular case, the Commission also rejected the argument that the Earl's past relationship with the media left the press free to report on any matter concerning his wife. In the words of the adjudication, the fact that Earl Spencer may have sought publicity in the past cannot reasonably be taken to mean that henceforward every aspect of the private affairs of his wife is a matter which the press has a right to put into the public domain. In addition, the Commission were in no doubt at all that the clinic in question was a hospital or similar institution as defined under the code. The fact that Lady Spencer had previously made some public aspect of her health and psychological well-being public in no way excluded the invasions of her privacy at a time when she was suffering distress and illness. In my view, the Commission's ruling on the relevance of a complainant's past relationships with the press to their present and future rights of redress has a vital bearing on the general right to free expression of both public figures and ordinary citizens. It would be a very serious inhibition on freedom of speech if it ever became generally accepted that evidence of previous contact with or resort to the press sharply diminished one's future rights to privacy. Freedom of expression under the law is a right enjoyed by ordinary citizens as well as the press, and citizens should therefore be able to place some parts of their private lives in the public domain without placing all their future rights to privacy in jeopardy. The last of the cases that I wish to discuss in this lecture before moving on to a general conclusion raised issues concerning the links between privacy intrusion, resort to subterfuge, and the opportunity to reply. In this instance, the well-known author and social commentator, Dr. Germaine Greer, complained that an article in the Mail on Sunday was obtained through an unjustifiable use of subterfuge, which resulted in a gross intrusion into her private life. Dr. Greer had written an article in the Big Issue magazine, in which she discussed the difficulties of owning and sharing a home. And she concluded by offering to share her home with anyone who was not put off by the difficulties she had described. She wrote, "If you are a homeless person, and if you can think you can accept what is being offered in the spirit in which it is offered, write to me, care of this paper." The Mail on Sunday did more. It sent a reporter to Dr. Greer's house posing as a homeless person. Now, the purpose of this subterfuge was to investigate one aspect of the life and world of the modern day homeless and to gain an insight into the life of homeless people of the kind that Dr. Greer was helping. The newspaper subsequently published a 3-page article containing detailed descriptions of her house and its contents. Now, at the time of these events, Dr. Greer had been publishing regular articles on her home in The Oldie magazine and also on more general topics in The Guardian. But she subsequently complained that the Daily Telegraph, in a follow-up article, had breached Clause 1 of the Code by giving an inaccurate description of her offer and breached Clause 4 by giving directions to the location of her address. She also made similar complaints about an article that appeared in her own newspaper, The Guardian, which named a specific town in Essex close to her home. Now, the Commission upheld Dr. Greer's complaint on the grounds that no public interest was served by this intrusion and resort to subterfuge. It rejected the Mail on Sunday's claim that subterfuge was the only way in which the article could have been written, and there can be no doubt that when an outspoken and famous person makes a genuine offer to help the homeless, this is a matter of public interest. The Telegraph had published a follow-up article in which the writer reported that Dr. Greer had, and here I quote, issued an open invitation to down and outs to live with her. Dr. Greer claimed that this statement misrepresented the terms of her offer in breach of Clause 1 of the Code, which deals with accuracy. She also complained on grounds that the article gave sufficient detail for any person to find her home. Both of these complaints were upheld, and the Commission reminded the newspaper of the policy guidelines set out already by the Commission, that newspapers should not publish specific addresses with the aim of inviting unnecessary attention to the person concerned. In her complaint against The Guardian, the newspaper for which she herself wrote a regular column, Dr. Greer also alleged breaches of the clause dealing with accuracy and the clause dealing with privacy. In the Guardian article, the report said that Dr. Greer had flung open the doors of her home and invited the homeless to go and live with her, and referred to a specific town in Essex near to where she lived. In this case, the Commission rejected both of Dr. Greer's complaints. The Guardian had pointed out that she had written about her house on previous occasions and had given her address in one of her own letters to the newspaper. In any event, the article it had published did no more than name a town of 14,000 inhabitants, and the Commission did not believe that this degree of identification amounted to an intrusion into privacy. It agreed that the article had misrepresented the terms of Dr. Greer's invitation, but it noted that she had subsequently published her own lengthy article in The Guardian, dealing inter alia with her specific objections to The Guardian's report. And in the view of the Commission, this opportunity to reply sufficiently corrected and dealt with any remaining issue under the code concerning inaccuracy. Well now, to what extent do these kinds of case studies vindicate the way in which the Commission works or support the criticisms made by Sir Louis Blom Cooper and Lisa Pruitt? First, it should be noted that we've always avoided breaking down the concept of privacy into various subcategories. Because of the unfailingly idiosyncratic nature of the cases with which we deal, we rarely find sufficient similarities between cases to argue from precedent. And furthermore, the Commission is still a relatively young body. In this respect, it should be noted that in 1994, all the complaints about intrusions into privacy accounted for no more than 12% of the total number of adjudications. In 1993, only 14 of the 83 cases that we investigated went to formal and final adjudication. And of these 14 cases, only two concerned well-known public figures. And this leads me to the second point of relevance, namely that formal adjudications are only one part of the work that we do. 74% of all the complaints we receive about privacy intrusions are resolved by informal negotiations between ourselves, the complainant, and the newspaper or journal to the satisfaction of the complainant. Thirdly, in making our formal adjudications, we are more concerned with reaching a just decision in a particular case than in establishing and sustaining precedents. In the course of our adjudications, we've drawn distinctions between the manner in which a journalist's investigation has been conducted and the content of the ensuing article, as we did in the case of Peter Lilly's nephew and the Daily Mirror, when we upheld the complaint about intrusion into privacy and rejected the complaints about harassment. In the case of Lady Spencer, we rejected the connections that the newspapers concerned tried to establish between past, present, and possible future involvements of public figures in the press. There were, however, special circumstances concerning Lady Spencer's medical condition that might not arise in future cases of an apparently similar nature. The Commission works perforce in a context of complaint adjudications where it must exercise discretion, and so must editors. In such circumstances, we cannot seek to bind editors with the very similitudes of legal precedent. And there are other real and potential dangers in seeking to make self-regulatory bodies like the Commission model their procedures in the image of due legal process. In her recent text on understanding tort law, our chairman this evening, Professor Harlow, discussed the tort of defamation and what she described as its chilling effect on free speech. And she asks whether or not its remit should be extended to the domain of privacy. She concludes that we should not overlook the danger that privacy would follow defamation, to become an instrument for the rich and the powerful to cover their misdeeds. And judges might well use a tort of privacy to muzzle press freedom. And Professor Harlow ends by suggesting that if freedom of the press is the paramount value in a healthy democracy, then some individuals may have to suffer intrusions into their privacy and even damage to their reputation in the public interest. Truth will remain the litmus test of what may be published, and the public interest may even demand restrictions on the present law of defamation. Now, these observations had relevance at a time when distinguished authorities like Professor Eric Barrett continue to argue the case for a new public disclosure tort that would provide a broad public interest defense that would not allow the publication of material just because it is interesting to the public. Barrett contends that this is exactly what the newspaper industry has already accepted in agreeing to abide by its own self-regulatory code of practice. How is it possible, he asks, for the industry to argue that it's impossible to draft a public interest defense and apply it properly when the Press Complaints Commission has clearly demonstrated that it can be done? And Professor Barrett goes on to conclude that once it is accepted that privacy and its defenses should be treated as setting standards which are capable of impartial application, the courts or some other independent tribunal should be the final arbiters. Now, the case for statutory regulation has usually been based on the claim that self-regulation has failed. But Barrett, in effect, I think, turns this argument on its head in arguing that the success of self-regulation demonstrates that statutory regulation and a legally enforceable privacy right can be made to work. But such an argument, if carried to its logical conclusion and applied more widely, would reduce the institutions of self-regulation to experimental exercises, preparing the way for a general extension of statutory powers in the adjudication of complaints. This might well be a wise course of action if legal precedent was manifestly the best way of resolving complaints, and if self-regulation always imitated legal process as closely as possible. It can, however, be argued to the contrary, that much of the success of self-regulation in general, and the Press Complaints Commission in particular, is attributable to the fact that it does not slavishly follow its legal counterparts. And in the last part of this lecture, I will try to demonstrate why this is the case. What are the advantages of a self-regulatory system? First, in comparison with statutory bodies, self-regulation is accessible, fast, flexible, independent of all interest, and involves no cost beyond a 25p stamp to either the complainant or the taxpayer. In the case of privacy complaints, for example, most investigations have been completed or resolved within 1 month of their receipt, and very few have taken longer than 2 months. Second, in big and complex societies like our own, it is better and more effective to rely on voluntary conformity with self-imposed rules than externally imposed legal rules. It is not just a question of goodwill. disagreements inevitably arise in all procedures involving the exercise of discretion. What matters is that the editors still cooperate, still publish critical adjudications, even when they genuinely disagree with the outcome, as sometimes they do. There is a world of difference between showing dissent and refusing to walk when given out at the crease. On current form, I would rather be involved in trying to persuade editors to admit publicly that they had made errors of judgment in the course of their work than, say, cabinet ministers. Thirdly, newspapers and periodicals are public watchdogs. One of their tasks in a free society is to scrutinize those who exercise power. And it is therefore vitally important to prevent government intervention to the press. It may be argued that statutory regulation would make the press behave more responsibly, but it does not augur well for democracy when politicians start praising newspapers for acting responsibly. Always, behind the presence of statutory press regulation hovers the prospect of censorship. Fourthly, statutory regulation would open up new markets for the services of lawyers, and newspapers would inevitably exploit to the full all those opportunities for delay that are inseparable from a legally regulated statutory system. Few citizens could enforce their legal rights without benefit of legal aid, and we know that such aid will not be forthcoming. In any event, the majority of complainants show no interest in seeking financial compensation. They want a different form of justice, a public apology, a public admission from the editor that he or she got it wrong. If lawyers became involved as a matter of course in complaints procedures, we would work in a new adversarial climate in which every complaint would carry a potential for protracted legal action from the start. The cooperative framework that has enabled the Commission in recent years to make such good progress would be swiftly undermined. Newspapers would turn to their lawyers as a matter of course from the very start of proceedings. In the framework of self-regulation, we deal with editors on a direct and impartial basis. We are neither friends nor foes to each other. In all legal procedures of a statutory system, delay would become the first line of defense, on which the majority of ordinary complainants would be impaled. Insofar as delay means more cost, the rich and the powerful will always have a vested interest in procrastination. And there is no evidence to support the view that in some miraculous way, the problems intrinsic to any system of dealing with complaints would be solved if self-regulation were to be replaced by statutory regulation. Statutory regulation would, however, inescapably strengthen the powers of government over the press without in any way providing better protection for ordinary people against the power of the press. And it would be no easier to agree on what constituted a legitimate public interest in a statutory context than it is under self-regulation. The Commission strives to balance the right to free expression against the right to privacy, and the issues frequently turn on the question of public interest. The government, in its recent response to the National Heritage Select Committee on Privacy, recognized that the complex problems that arise in drawing lines between conflicting rights to privacy and free expression in defining private and public persons and places are intrinsic to any system of self-regulation. They will not be resolved by statute, and there is no public consensus on where and why these lines should be drawn. In the United Kingdom, we have neither a Freedom of Information Act nor a Bill of Rights. And at a time when governments already possess immense powers of surveillance over their citizens, we should not lightly surrender any of the liberties we possess. Newspapers that are popular with their governments and are praised by them for their responsible behavior are almost certainly not doing their job properly. And it is indeed praiseworthy that our present government has drawn back from statutory regulation and recognized at last that the Press Complaints Commission is a success story. John Wakeham, our present chairman, has been important to us because of his knowledge of government and his knowledge of the personalities involved in making political decisions. But more importantly, he has not been afraid to tackle, early in his chairmanship, important questions regarding our independence which needed to be resolved. And just as critical has been the tactical strength and sagacity needed in manoeuvring the Commission's path through a minefield that lies beneath the ground where press and politicians meet. Wakeham has taken a clear view of what he wants to achieve, and that is to diffuse the dangers in that minefield and to move the debate away, to move the debate about regulation away from day-to-day political controversy. We are, however, in no way complacent about such achievements as we have made. And we will continue to learn from experience in striving to provide the best possible service for the general public. We're currently preparing a considered response to suggestions from the government and elsewhere as to how we might further improve our procedures. And in all our present deliberations and our future activities, Madam Chairman, it is quite certain that issues relating to privacy will continue to have a very central and public place. But our aim at the Commission remains consistent from our very first days in 1991. To uphold the freedom of the press, which is absolutely fundamental to a healthy democracy, and at the same time to provide an increasingly effective and accountable method of redress for any abuses of that freedom. Thank you.
The audience will be glad to hear that I'm not one of those chairpersons who feel it necessary to run through the lecture all over again, rephrasing the speaker's most felicitous phrases in an infelicitous manner. So I will instead confine myself to one single comment, which is that in travelling into work this morning, I thought that Professor Pinker couldn't have chosen a better day to give a lecture on privacy. It was quite the somewhat inaccurate newspaper to which I somewhat grudgingly subscribe, had on its front two pages at least four items on privacy, one of which I felt might reach the Privacy Commissioner in due course. So it was shown to be an extremely topical subject. And that said, I have two pleasant duties. The first is to thank our speaker on your behalf for an extremely lucid account of the very delicate issues which are which are involved in this subject, and a similarly lucid account of the case law or quasi case law of the Quango, which he so elegantly justified. And my second duty is to invite everybody in the audience to consider to continue what I hope will be a very interesting discussion upstairs, as we usually do in the senior common room. Thank you very much, Professor Pinker.